I was at a loss trying to see the connection between the readings. So I took a look at the meditation in the Audubon Way, and it builds on the whole idea of the battle. There's a battle in the first reading, of course, but this meditation says that there's a battle between Jesus and the Pharisees. I suppose that's a good direction to take. Certainly the psalm talks about God being our strength in a battle. But as I reflected on it, it seems to me that part of the lesson is that there's really no contest at all. There's no difficulty for God to defeat his enemies. And so those who are on the side of God should have no fear of anyone who comes against them. I don't know if that point will sink into you, but let's reflect on these readings for a moment. The first reading is the famous story of David versus Goliath, although Goliath is not mentioned here, but we know that that's who this Philistine is. He's the champion. He is the greatest warrior that the Philistines have. He's a huge man, strong, seasoned warrior. So the contest is set up. This is before this reading. Goliath poses a challenge. He said, I'll take on anybody. Choose your best man, and I'll defeat him, and that way we won't have to have a war out. We'll just be your masters. You'll have to become our slaves. So this puts Saul on the spot, King Saul on the spot. What's he going to do? No one wants to fight this guy. And yet, if they don't, well, then they lose face, and that's, in the Middle Eastern culture, a terrible thing. You can't not take up a challenge. So he's stuck. Along comes David and says, well, I'll do it. Now remember, David is the shepherd boy. He's the least in the family of Jesse. He's hanging around Saul because he's a good singer, and you know, he has no qualifications at all. So this is not just a strong warrior versus a weak warrior. It's the strongest warrior and the non-warrior. David is a shepherd boy. Now, Saul, who has already proven himself to not think in a very high or in very spiritual terms, he's kind of a calculator. He probably figures this way, and I don't know if this is true. It's not really spelled out in the Bible, but why would King Saul allow this kid to go up against Goliath? It's obviously going to be a slaughter. I mean, why would Saul allow it? I think Saul might have been thinking this way. Well, since he's going to have to lose somebody, he might as well lose the least one, the one who's not really much of a loss. It's kind of a throwaway mentality. He's not going to send his most powerful warrior and lose him because that weakens the whole army. But the loss of David, who cares? He's nothing. He's never even fought before. He doesn't even have a sword. He's never worn armor before. So this is how the thing is set up. It's absolute. Now, it's obvious who's going to win. I mean, Goliath is going to slaughter this kid in no time. And he taunts him, says, what are you coming here with a staff? What do you think I am, a dog? Now, what changes the whole equation is God, the power of God. David is not going against Goliath with a staff. He's going against Goliath with the power of God. So when the Philistine says, you come here and I'm going to slaughter you, you can leave your flesh for the birds of the air and the beasts of the field, he's relying on his own power. You come here, I'm going to defeat you. But notice how David says it. You come against me with sword and spear and scimitar, so with human power, human weapons. I come against you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel that you have insulted. Today, the Lord shall deliver you into my hand. So David is saying, the Lord is the one who's going to defeat you, not me. He's going to deliver you into my hand. Now, David's confidence is what stands out here. He, He's not relying on himself at all, and it's a good thing because he doesn't have the power on the natural level. But because God is with him and God is far more powerful than any Philistine, we know what happens. David wins. This is a pretty obvious lesson, and it's repeated again and again and again in the Bible, that if we rely on God, we have victory, and if we don't, it doesn't matter how strong we are. And this it comes up over and over. Just to throw out a couple of examples, just think of the story of the in the New Testament of the apostles fishing all night and catching nothing. Well, they're the best fishermen they know. I mean, they've been fishing all their lives. So that's the best they could do. Along comes Jesus and says, well, throw the net on the other side, and they catch more than they could ever have caught on their own. Well, that's the same lesson. Whose power are you relying on? Human strength, by comparison to divine strength, is nothing. This is not exactly a good analogy, but it's similar in the lesson we learned from John the Baptist, since we just finished the Christmas season and John the Baptist was so prominent. John the Baptist was the greatest of the prophets. And he said this himself, I'm nothing by comparison to the one who is to come. And that's why Jesus could say he's the greatest man ever born, but the least born into the kingdom is greater than he. So if you're relying on a natural level, well, can't beat John the Baptist. But if you're going to submit yourself to God, you can. No, there's no contest in that case. So that's why it's not a very good example. But the contrast is what I'm trying to point out. Actually, there's no better lesson here than Jesus himself. We just celebrated San Domingo. Jesus comes as a child, a weak, helpless child. He submits himself to the best that, or the worst that we could throw at him, the whole power of Rome, the jealousy of the Pharisees. He submits himself to everything. In fact, he submits himself even to the power of Satan himself. He says, "You do your best against me. I'm here. I'm a helpless child." He doesn't have a sword. He's like David. He doesn't have a sword. He doesn't have any money. He doesn't have any weapons, armor, anything. That's Jesus. Jesus on the cross is the David. And everybody who is against him is the Philistine. Who wins? Jesus wins. Because he is the power of God. He's the victory of God. So that lesson, I think, should be clear to us, because it keeps being repeated over and over. Certainly the Blessed Virgin Mary has the same understanding of how things work, where victory comes from. The Lord, he brings down the powerful and he lifts up the lowly. For people of faith, we should apply this to this pandemic. I've said this over and over myself, but I keep getting the idea that everybody's afraid of COVID-19 all the time. Fine. We should do what we can to fight this with our natural weapons. We use our medicines, we use our vaccines, we use our masks. You know, we use our human understanding. But that's nothing by comparison to the power of God. So if we are on the side of God, if we are relying on God, then we carry our staff, yes, we carry our five stones with us. But that's not where our confidence comes from. Our confidence comes from God. That should have sunk in by now to people of faith. Now, of course, the world will always be terrified. The world, which is mustering up all its best efforts all the time and can't figure out how to deal with a virus. Well, that's the way the world is. But we don't belong to the world. Okay, let's turn to the gospel here, because what we see in the gospel is the problem not of human strength versus divine strength. The problem we have here is deliberate rejection of the power of God. The problem is hardness of heart, and the gospel labels it. When Jesus sees the spirit of the Pharisees, he's angry and grieved at their hardness of heart. So hardness of heart is worse than being a Philistine, because a Philistine doesn't know God. A Philistine is just doing what he's always done. He's a warrior and he comes from a pagan land. What can we expect of him? But the Pharisees are supposed to know God, and they harden their hearts against Jesus. That's worse. In the synagogue, no, this is on the Sabbath, so the Lord has just declared himself Lord of the Sabbath. That was in yesterday's gospel, which certainly irked the Pharisees. It certainly got them, because Lord of the Sabbath, that's a divine title, and nobody can claim to be Lord of the Sabbath. So this man has gone way over the line. We have to stop him. Not only that, if anyone has authority over the Sabbath, it's the Pharisees themselves. So for him to walk in to their territory stirs up all their jealousy. So that's why they're watching him. They don't care about the man with the withered hand. They have set themselves against Jesus, who is the one God sent to save us. So if we set ourselves against Jesus, we are just setting ourselves up for a defeat. I'd like to point out here something I think we can learn when it comes to dealing with people who oppose us, especially when we are provoked to anger. Because Jesus has come to do good. He's going to heal the man. He's going to reveal the goodness of God on the Sabbath. He even asks them, is it right to do good or to do evil? Of course it's to do good, of course. But they won't say anything. So it says he looked around at them with anger and grieved at their hardness of heart. So he's angry. Jesus is angry. And it's an anger that is the right response to this deliberate resistance. He's grieved. Because of what they're doing to themselves and what they're doing to the people that are entrusted to them. But what I think we can learn from this is what to do when we are angry, legitimately angry at injustice or resistance to the truth. Because what we typically do is when we're angry, we fight against the person we're angry at. That's kind of our natural reaction. I think all of us know this. If I get angry at you, you're the one I'm going to yell at, or strike out at, or somehow undermine. Anger is directed at the enemy. Notice that Jesus doesn't do that. He marshals his anger toward doing good. This is what sometimes they call sublimation. And he uses that energy not to destroy his enemy. He uses it to build up the poor man with the withered hand. It's a very powerful spiritual principle. Of course we're going to be angry, and often we have a right to be angry, but what do we do with it? If we are destructive in our anger, well then we're just making things worse. If we are constructive with our anger, if we're using that energy to build up the kingdom of God, well then that's the right use. That's what Jesus does. You see this in the saints and in people who are active in good works. The pro-lifers are great at this. They're really stirred up at the problem: poverty, injustice, refugees, whatever, plague victims, and they say, well, I'm going to do something about this. I can't just sit here and let this evil dominate the world. I'm going to do something. That energy moves them. Now, they're submitting themselves to God so that it bears fruit, but that moves them to do something good for those in need. One of the terrible things about the lockdowns has been isolation from those in need. Who are those in need? Well, the children, the elderly, the poor. But with lockdowns, people, the children and the elderly are all locked in their houses, and there's nothing you can do for them. And then the poor are isolated from everyone. So that's bad for the people who are angry at the pandemic. That people in isolation have no way to use their anger and their grief for constructive purposes. And so that's why there's so much mental illness now. There's this pandemic of mental illness, depression and suicide tendencies, substance abuse, you know, and domestic violence. These things have all surged because people are angry and grieving, and they don't have any way to use it in constructive ways. Well, now that's... I'm not giving solutions, I'm just giving a spiritual principle here. We're going to be angry sometimes. We're going to grieve sometimes. Let's use it the way Jesus does. For the sake of someone in need. Not to use it as a weapon against our enemy, but to use it as a weapon for good. For the kingdom. Blessed be the Lord, my rock. He trains my hands for battle, my fingers for war, not to destroy, but to build up.